Welcome back to the Further South Real Estate Podcast. Today we are ditching the formal wear, kicking our feet up, and we're getting into the weeds of something that, well, it terrifies pretty much everyone the first time they do it. We're doing a deep dive into the First Time Home Buyer's Essential Handbook. And I know what you're thinking. Handbook sounds like homework.
Right. It sounds dusty.
It does. But looking through our source material today, this is actually surprisingly readable. It feels less like a textbook and more like a survival guide.
It really is. And a survival guide is exactly what people need right now. The whole world of real estate is, you know, it's practically built on jargon. We love our acronyms, our scary sounding contracts.
Oh, for sure.
But the mission for this deep dive is to just strip all of that away. We want to take this handbook and turn it into a crash course that actually makes sense. We're going to walk you through the whole timeline from that first thought of maybe I should buy all the way to...
I just got the keys. Now, how do I pay for the water heater? I love that approach. And I want to jump right in with something I found in, I think it was the very first chapter, because it honestly surprised me. I think most people just assume a first-time home buyer is someone who's, you know, literally never signed a deed in their life.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at the criteria here,
There's
this three-year rule. Mm. Am I reading this right? If I owned a condo like 5 years ago, I could be a first-time buyer again.
You are absolutely reading that right. And it is the single biggest misconception we see. People assume they've used up their first-time card and it's gone forever.
Right. One and done.
But in the eyes of most lenders, and especially for those government grant programs, the definition is almost always someone who hasn't had an ownership interest in a primary residence for the last 3 years.
That is a massive loophole.
It's huge. It means if you sold a house, maybe went back to renting for a few years.
Moved for a job or whatever.
Exactly. And now you want to get back in the market. Guess what? You reset the clock. You might qualify for all that down payment assistance, the lower interest rate programs, all the stuff you thought was only for 25-year-olds.
So the big takeaway here is don't disqualify yourself before you even start.
Yes. Do not rule yourself out. You could be a born-again first-time buyer.
Okay, so we know who can play the game. But before we get to the how, we have to talk about the should. The handbook spends a lot of time on this rent versus buy debate. And usually you just hear people say, renting is throwing money away. But it's not really that simple, is it?
It is definitely not that simple. That throwing money away line is, you know, it's great marketing for real estate agents, but it's pretty bad economics. The handbook makes this really important distinction about unrecoverable costs.
Okay.
When you rent, your unrecoverable cost is your rent. That's it. When you buy, you have unrecoverable costs too.
Like property taxes.
Property taxes, homeowners insurance, mortgage interest, and the big one, maintenance.
All right. Nobody ever talks about the maintenance. When I'm renting, if the toilet breaks at 2 a.m, that's a tragedy for my landlord.
Mm-hmm.
If I own the place, that is my financial crisis.
Precisely. Renting buys you patience and flexibility. If you think you might move in 2 years, the transaction costs of buying and then selling will likely just eat up any equity you build.
So there's a timeline.
There is. The general rule of thumb from the data is about a 5-year horizon. If you aren't planning on staying for at least 5 years, renting is often the smarter financial move.
Okay, but the flip side, and the handbook really hits this hard, is the forced savings part of buying.
Right. That's the counterargument. When you pay your mortgage, a piece of that payment, even if it's a small one at first, is paying down your own debt. You're building equity.
And the house is hopefully going up in value.
Plus, you have asset appreciation. So for stability and a long-term wealth vehicle, buying wins. But you have to be ready to stay put.
All right, so I've done the soul searching. I'm staying put. The first wall I'm going to hit is the credit score. And this is where I feel like the handbook reveals some inside baseball stuff. Because I check my credit on those free apps all the time. I've got a 720 on the app. I'm good, right?
Well, this is where it gets a little tricky. The score you see on your credit card app is usually something called a Vantage score. It's more of an educational score. When you actually go to get a mortgage, lenders use a totally different model, usually older versions of FICO, specifically FICO 2, 4, and 5.
Wait a minute. So the number on my phone might be totally different than the number the bank sees.
It can vary, sometimes by 20 or 30 points, sometimes more. And that difference really matters because interest rates are tiered. A 760 score gets you the absolute best rate. A 620 might get you the loan, but you're going to pay a lot more over 30 years.
So what actually moves the needle? The handbook lists payment history as number one, which is obvious, pay your bills. But the second one, credit utilization, that seems to trip people up.
It does. This is the ratio of how much credit you're using versus how much you have available.
Okay.
So if you have a credit card with a $10,000 limit and you're carrying a $9,000 balance, that's 90% utilization. To a lender, that looks incredibly risky, even if you make your payments on time.
Is there a magic number to aim for?
The handbook suggests keeping it under 30% is good, but under 10% is like the gold standard for maximizing your score.
Got it.
So before you apply for a mortgage, you don't need to close accounts. In fact, please don't close accounts. That can hurt you. But just try to pay down those balances.
That's a key tip. Don't close them. Pay them down. Okay, let's talk money. The down payment. Everyone has this number tattooed in their brain. 20%. If I want a $400,000 house, I need $80,000 cash or I can't play.
The source material calls this a myth, but is it really?
It is a massive, massive myth. In fact, the average down payment for first-time buyers is often closer to 6% or 7%. The 20% number comes from the threshold to avoid something called private mortgage insurance, or PMI. Okay, let's unpack PMI. Because people treat it like it's the devil. It's basically wasted money that protects the bank, not me. That's true, right?
That is true. It protects the lender in case you default. And yes, it's an extra cost, but, and this is a big but, you have to look at the opportunity cost. Let's say it's going to take you 5 more years to save up that full 20%. In those 5 years, what are home prices doing?
They're probably going up.
Exactly. If values rise 5% a year, that $400,000 house is going to cost way more in 5 years. You could be chasing the market forever. Paying a little PMI each month might just be the fee you pay to get into the house now and start building your own equity.
That's a really good way to reframe it. It's not wasted money, it's the cost of admission.
Spot on, and there are so many programs. FHA loans allow 3.5% down. Conventional loans for first-timers can go as low as 3%. VA loans for veterans and USDA loans for rural areas are 0% down. The barrier is much lower than people think.
Okay, I've got my credit polished. I've got my 3.5% down. I walk into a bank. I hear two terms thrown around, pre-qualification and pre-approval. This just sounds...
But they are worlds apart.
Okay.
Think of pre-qualification as a casual chat. You tell the lender, I make this much. I have this much in the bank. The lender says, cool. Based on that, you could probably buy a house for this much.
So no documents.
They don't check your tax returns. They don't check your bank statements. It's napkin math.
So it's basically worthless if I'm trying to actually buy a house.
In a competitive market, yes.
Yes.
A seller won't take it seriously. Pre-approval, on the other hand, is a full scrub. You submit your W-2s, pay stubs, bank statements. An underwriter actually looks at your file.
So the bank is making a real commitment.
It's a conditional commitment to lend you that money. Let's say you find a house you love and there's another buyer. You walk in with your napkin math, pre-qual. They walk in with a verified pre-approval.
I'm dead in the water.
You're absolutely dead in the water. Yeah. The seller is going to pick the sure thing every single time.
Got it. Get the hard pre-approval. Now, once I have that, the bank gives me a number. Congratulations, you're approved for $600,000. This leads to what the handbook calls the affordability reality check.
Yes, the danger zone.
Because the bank doesn't know I like to travel or that my kid's in daycare or anything about my actual life.
Exactly. The bank only looks at your debt-to-income ratio, your DTI. They look at your gross income before taxes and your fixed debts. They don't see your grocery bill or your lifestyle.
So if I spend that max amount,
you will almost certainly be house poor.
House poor. You have a beautiful house, but you're eating ramen in the dark because you can't afford the light bill.
That's it exactly. The handbook advises working backward. Don't ask, how much can I borrow?
Instead ask,
how much do I want my monthly payment to be? Then have your lender tell you what home price equals that payment. That puts you in control, not the bank.
That is solid advice. Let the budget drive the loan, not the other way around. Okay, the hunt. We got our money right. We're scrolling Zillow. HGTV makes it look so easy. You look at 3 houses, pick one, you're done.
The reality is exhausting.
I bet.
First, you have to accept that photos lie. They use wide-angle lenses, they brighten everything up. You will walk into a house that looked like a palace online and realize the ceiling is 6 feet high and it smells like wet dog.
Oh, okay.
That's just part of the process.
And the handbook mentions something called the 80-20 rule for the wish list. Can you explain that?
I love this rule. It basically says you will never, ever find a house that has 100% of what you want.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist unless you build it yourself with a blank check. The goal is to find a house that has 80% of what you need. The other 20% are things you can change or just live with. If you hold out for 100%, you'll be renting forever.
That's just managing expectations. So we find the 80% house, offer accepted, we pop the champagne. But wait, now the hurdles start. The first big one is the inspection. This feels like where deals go to die.
Is, and it's where emotions run the highest. You have to understand, the inspection is your get out of jail free card. You have a set period, maybe 7 or 10 days, to hire a pro to poke around.
If they find a sinkhole under the living room?
You can walk away and get your deposit back.
But what if it's not a sinkhole? What if it's just, a loose doorknob or a cracked tile?
This is where first-time buyers can really shoot themselves in the foot. The inspection is for health, safety, and major structural issues. It is not a honey-do list for the seller.
You have to pick your battles.
You have to
Yeah.
focus on the roof, the HVAC, the foundation, the expensive stuff.
Deal breakers versus annoyances. Got it. Okay, next up, the appraisal. What happens if the bank's appraiser says the house isn't worth what I offered? Say I offered $400,000, but they say it's only worth $380,000.
That's the dreaded appraisal gap. The bank will only lend based on the appraised value. So now you have a $20,000 hole.
What are my options?
You have three, really. One, the seller drops their price to $380,000. Two, you come up with an extra $20,000 in cash. Or three, you meet somewhere in the middle.
Or I can walk away.
Or you walk away as long as your contract has an appraisal contingency. This is why knowing your budget is so important. You need to know if you have the cash to cover a gap.
Speaking of cash, the silent budget killer.
Hmm.
Closing costs. No one warns you about this enough. You save up your down payment, you think you're done, and then bam,
Yeah.
another 3% to 5% of the price.
It's the classic surprise. On a $400,000 house, 3% is 12 grand. That is not small change. And a huge chunk of that is for your prepaids and your escrow account.
Okay, explain escrow. It sounds like a medieval term.
It does, doesn't it? Basically, the lender doesn't trust you to save up and pay your property taxes and insurance on your own. So every month, part of your mortgage payment goes into a little savings account held by the bank. That's escrow. When the tax bill is due, the bank pays it for you from that account.
So at closing, why am I paying so much into it?
Because the bank wants to pad that account up front. They might ask for 6 months of taxes and 12 months of insurance premiums right there at the closing table. That's thousands of dollars in cash you have to bring.
That's painful, but I guess it's better than getting a surprise tax bill in December.
Exactly. It prevents payment shock down the road, and you can always ask for help with it.
What do you mean?
You can negotiate for the seller to pay, say, $5,000 toward your closing costs. It's called seller concessions. It lets you keep more cash in your pocket for moving or furniture.
Okay, so we've navigated all the hurdles. We're at the finish line. But we have to talk about the emotional side. The handbook has a whole section on the emotional roller coaster. It's not just numbers, is it?
Not at all. It's likely the biggest purchase of your life. It is incredibly stressful. You go from the high of finding the house to the anxiety of the inspection.
To the sheer panic of signing all those papers.
And buyer's remorse is a real thing. You wake up at 3 a.m. thinking, what have I done? I'm in debt for 30 years.
And then you have everyone's opinions. Your Uncle Bob, who hasn't bought a house since 1982, is suddenly an expert telling you you're doing it all wrong.
Right. The handbook calls this noise. You have to filter it out. Trust the team you built, your agent, your lender, and trust your own math. You're the one who has to live there.
So, fast forward. You sign the papers, you've got the keys, you did the pizza on the floor thing the first night. What happens next?
The first month reality check. The handbook's number one piece of advice is stop spending money.
But I need a couch.
You can sit on a lawn chair for a month. Seriously, you just spent a fortune. Your bank account is drained. Don't immediately run up credit card debt. You need to rebuild your emergency fund.
Because now there's no landlord to call.
It's on you. The water heater is your problem now.
That's the shift. It's responsibility.
It is. But there is also that moment, maybe a few weeks in, when you're drinking coffee in your own kitchen and you look at a wall and think, I can paint that wall purple if I want to.
Or I can finally get a dog.
Exactly. That feeling of stability and autonomy, that is the payoff. That's when it starts to feel really rewarding.
That's the sweet spot. If we had to boil this entire handbook down to a single mission statement for everyone listening, what would it be?
I think the mission is buying a home is a learning process, not a test you can fail. It's messy, it's complex, the rules change. But if you take it one step at a time, understand your credit, respect your budget, don't skip the inspection, it is absolutely achievable. You don't need to be a millionaire, you just need to be prepared.
I love that. It's
Oh.
not a test you can fail.
Oh.
Listeners, thank you for hanging out with us on this deep dive. Whether you're dreaming big or actively scrolling listings right now, we hope this makes the mountain look a little easier to climb.
Absolutely. Knowledge reduces fear. You've got this.
And here's a final thought to chew on before we go. We talked a lot about the financial value of a home, the equity, the appreciation. But think about the social capital. When you buy a home, you're literally buying a stake in a neighborhood. You become a shareholder in your community. How does that change how you view your local schools or the park down the street? It shifts your perspective from passerby to partner. Something to think about. Thanks for listening to the Further South Real Estate Podcast. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.